This is side two of session number 60, recorded on March 23rd, 2008. Scott, I wanted to mention something. When you mentioned the Buddhism as an archetype,
right,
that television was challenging, I was thinking that the larger archetypes were, as presented in Up the Orphic Ante, were technological liberalism, Catholicism, Buddhism, Marxism, and tetrad management. Those five archetypes featured in the Android meme Tiny Note Chart, LaRouche dancing on the toes of the archetypal technological liberalism.
Humanism.
What?
Is it humanism or liberalism?
Liberalism, I think, in the Orphic Ante chart article. The thing is that LaRouche creates an eccentric form of technological liberalism. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Most technological liberals wouldn't recognize it. McLuhan creates an eccentric form of Catholic Thomism. All right?
Right.
Thompson creates an eccentric form of Buddhism.
Right.
Coker creates an eccentric form of Marxism, and I create an eccentric form of tetrad management. So that the actual Buddhism thing that you saw in the McLuhan quadrant, or why did you bring up the Buddhism archetype in the McLuhan discussion?
Well, we were just saying that the TV sort of brings that back.
Yeah, but you were... Okay, that's what I said. That's what you learned from our discussion of it.
Right.
But there was some reason... I don't know what was the con... 57 to 67, I don't know. You just...
I just made the observation or the probe that... that McLuhan was a homeopathic cliche probe of a previous archetypal environment, which would be the Buddhism.
Right. And actually, I should have said at that point that Thompson is the homeopathic cliche probe of Buddhism. McLuhan is the probe of Catholic Thomism. Now, because they all mime tetradic positions, LaRouche is a probe in all the others, just as McLuhan is a probe in all the others. So they all probe each other in the interplay of the homeopathic cliche probes within the Android meme. Because the actual stance of LaRouche is like a tetrad manager, so is McLuhan, so is Thompson's stance, and so is Coker's stance. But the differences in their tetrad management is monadic, dyadic, triadic in the McLuhan sense, and tetradic. Whereas I'm pentadic, which is an eccentric version of the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So the archetypes are what is being probed by the Android meme as presented in the Tiny Note chart as homeopathic cliche probes of those archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how to express it. So you see...
Yeah. So to make a distinction then, McLuhan is not a homeopathic cliche probe of Buddhism. He's a homeopathic cliche probe of Catholic Thomism. But McLuhan is in the homeopathic television quadrant, and we stated that television is a homeopathic cliche probe of Buddhism.
Right.
So this, you know, it's going to take a lot of discussion to get this all straightened out. This is very subtle.
Yeah, it's subtle, but it's very obvious. Remember, this is a picture of the Android meme, which makes itself look like humans. So the human version of television, even though television is the ground in its quadrant, and is probing Buddhism, like you just said, and probing Catholicism, and probing technological liberalism, probing all of them. Television, McLuhan is the TV meme with a human face. His style is in the style of television.
Mm-hmm.
So we think it's McLuhan and Zappa probing.
So the television is deceptively cloaking itself as Catholic Thomism when it's as content or as image, but really it's Buddhism.
No. Remember, the Android meme looks like a human being. Walter Bowert said that when McLuhan died, he wouldn't be surprised if it was discovered that a chip fell out of McLuhan's head.
Mm-hmm.
From Bowert's point of view, McLuhan was a robotoid.
Yeah.
Now, that's a personal projection by Walter, but just taking the idea, it fits into my scenario. There's been no human being in the media since 1960. There's only been images of humans whose style of communication resonates with the era they're in, ERA, era, okay?
Right.
So McLuhan's style resonated with the after image of television because it wasn't ground in 57 to 67. Satellite was ground.
Yeah.
Deep ground. Secondary ground was television.
Right.
In relation to satellites, it's after image. In relation to normal chemical bodies, it was ground. In that period when TV was ground, and then the Android meme is replaying that period later, the Android meme makes television look like McLuhan because McLuhan resonates with the style, in his manner of writing, with the style of television, as a book would be resonating with television.
Right.
Thompson resonates with the computer phase, Croker with the satellite squared phase, LaRouche with the radio phase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're all happening in the after image of the Android meme in the 90s. What did you have? 94, LaRouche released from jail. 93, McLuhan put on the masthead of Wired magazine. Thompson renews his lecture series at the Cathedral St. John of Divine. Croker starts getting published all over the place in 93, 94. Thompson starting the returns to the Cathedral in 92. He lectures there through to 96, 97. So the point is, the Android meme is retrieving these after images of the environments, but the environments seem to be these particular humans. That's the 90s.
Right.
But the chart is showing the building of the Android meme from 60 to 90, before it was an after image.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan bursts on the scene as a powerful homeopathic cliche probe of Wyndham Lewis and television, and people think that it's all about him, and they don't know that he's really a human face for the television meme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why all these guys come and go. They don't have any staying power.
Right.
People have wondered why McLuhan never left a school or legacy. You know, LaRouche left a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And that cult's going strong. But that's because he's of the radio era, where there were directors and hierarchs, and then you'd have a cult.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan was not a cultist.
Right. But McLuhan had a greater presence, still has a greater presence, and always had a greater presence than William Irwin Thompson, who probably has a greater presence and always had a greater presence than Arthur Croker, who probably has a greater presence and always had a greater presence than Bob Dobbs.
No, Thompson had a big presence. Every one of them was bigger than any of the others at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Thompson is nowhere now. None of his books are in print. He complains about it. He's been complaining for 10 years. But Croker, he's like off the map a little bit now. But he was big, way bigger than Thompson in the early, middle 90s.
Mm.
But Croker has disappeared. McLuhan had disappeared. LaRouche was way bigger than McLuhan in the 80s. McLuhan was nowhere. Thompson was on the decline. Croker wasn't really on the horizon yet.
Right.
Now, the fact, though, is that there's different kinds of scenes. Back when there's one-way broadcast media, what they call the world of public intellectuals, there was a book about the death of public intellectuals, came out in late 80s, early 90s, and it mentioned McLuhan as one of the last public intellectuals. There's no unified public. Remember, McLuhan defined public as a literary environment, literary audience.
Yeah.
Electronic age of niche marketing and put-ons in the 80s and 90s, or even in the 70s, so that the one-way role that LaRouche and McLuhan filled is not needed in the computer satellite squared eras. There's so many people being temporary gurus for all kinds of people. mm-hmm. that it's niche marketing. It's what Thompson, no, he didn't call it, but I called it. I think I got it from Negroponte. Narrow casting. You didn't need to be an all-encompassing presence like McLuhan and those that came before him were.
Right. If you could find your niche, you could narrow broadcast to that niche and have more powerful effects than someone who is broadcasting to a bunch of demographics who didn't care about what you were doing.
Right. Like, you could say Kissinger replaces McLuhan. The public intellectuals that surfaced in the 70s and 80s were largely neocons or Reagan. Milton Friedman was a good example. The Big Brother apparatus, still an apparatus running around the mixed corporate media, projects some person out there as an authority on the government's perspective of things. Like, are we going to have a Keynesian liberal economy, or are we going to have a free trade economy? Now, most people don't even bother to understand those issues. It's nothing to do with the tribal participation and electronic quantum particle quarktoon participation that people are engaging in. It's a very fragmented environment. But the centralist hardware environments must project a thinker. So Milton Friedman comes in and replaces McLuhan, or replaces the big new Brzezinski, or Daniel Bell, or W.W. Rostow. And there's a whole string of another one is Samuel Huntington. He's the one right now presenting the Clash of Civilizations meme.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Alvin Toffler was one way back there.
Mm-hmm.
So that role, it's what you're saying, the old Big Brother apparatus that has somebody giving a political meme is usually someone as brittle and fragile looking as Henry Kissinger. Kissinger's not even allowed to go into some countries right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in the new decentralized environment, you don't need a guy projecting or a woman projecting out. Remember, on top of that, you've got feminism happening, too. You've got the Gloria Steinems. That feminism tried to be a public intellectual role, but it came too late. It comes in the Thompson quadrant, and it fizzles out because you can't have a one-way meme being broadcast for very long. So Thompson consciously picks a smaller audience, and he critiques the McLuhans and the Bucky Fullers and the old public intellectuals. Croker goes one step further and says anybody who's communicating is an Android processor. Niche marketing, narrow broadcasting, or broadband broadcasting,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you have different periods, different textures that require different kinds of, I don't want to say intellectuals, but different kinds of artistic matrices for people to think within.
Right.
So, okay.
And, of course, where we are now in 2008 is way beyond
any
the Android memes looking back.
Yeah.
What this chart represents.
That makes me the most powerful of all of them because I'm in a invisible position, which is necessary to operate the way I do. Anybody else just gets eaten up and spit out. You can't do that to me.
Yeah. Well,
that's why I've become a member of the inside team.
Yeah.
Which is an anonymous team.
Yeah.
Croker is just part of a university network. You've got
yeah.
a chair out in British Columbia.
When we talked to Worst Wooster, who has a metaphysical perspective, he was talking in terms of different levels of magi or magicians or people doing some kind of levels of esoteric power, where the higher up the chain you go, the more sort of invisible these people are, but the more sort of they're at a power fulcrum where they can either manage power or grab power.
Okay, he's he's talking about people attempting to acquire power and will fail. He predicts that they will fail.
Yeah.
Like Kissinger.
Right.
Because there is no basis for that power. He's really, you know, on the surface, Dave Worster is talking as the channel for cosmic awareness in the Thompson quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually covers all the quadrants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's still alive and talking with me. He's still relevant. And he talks about acquiring power on all levels,
mm-hmm.
in any medium. And he says it doesn't work. At best, you can manage your image.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw why those that thought there was power to acquire were made fools of themselves.
But he has his own unique way of arriving at being able to see what's really happening. He wouldn't necessarily relate to, say, your chart and how you see.
No, he would. Worster has LaRouche's perspective. He has McLuhan's perspective. We haven't got this on tape the way he talks about it. We're just beginning to get him on tape. He has Thompson's perspective, and he has Croker's perspective. He has all four. He talks about it in terms of quadrillionths of a second.
Well, yeah, just to go into that, he said that thought occurs at a rate of...
he said a million vibes per second or one quadrillionth of a second. Very fast.
Very fast. It was millions of cycles per second.
But he said that... He said that where we live now is faster than thought.
Yeah, then that's where you get into the quadrillionth per second, which is what he's talking about.
No, that's thought.
No, thought was in the millions of cycles per second. And then when he talked about the quadrillion cycles per second, he was talking about the highest levels of perception before you transcend the phenomenal world altogether. But the highest levels of perception transcend the highest levels of thinking.
Excuse me.
That's why he said in order to break through to those states, you feel like you're losing your mind, and you are in fact losing your mind because you're transcending the rate at which thought occurs. You're moving into a space faster than the speed of thought. Perception.
God, hold it. You're wrong. He says million vibes per second at one point, but basically in other parts, in this interview we just did, the thought moves at a quadrillionth of a second, and that's a limitation compared to where we live today, or what you can tune into.
Yeah.
And all you can do is hold on and have a perception of things.
No, I want you to go back and take another look at that. He distinctly made a distinction between times per second for thought, which was in the million cycles per second, and times per second for Buddha's perception of the phenomenal world occurring in quadrillions per second.
Well, I have it right here, and I'll just...
Don't take the time to look at it right now. We'll come back to it.
I wanted to point out, he does say million vibes per second at one point, but the other part is the quadrillion.
Right, and the millions, he's talking about speed of thought. He's making a distinction between speed of thought and speed of perception of the phenomenal creation. There's a rate at which the phenomenal creation is occurring, which is quadrillions per second, and then there's a rate at which you think, which is slowed down function occurring in your brain, and it occurs in millions per second.
Nope. It's the... Okay. And the human organism is capable of functioning in form up to about once every four quadrillions of a second.
Right, functioning in form. That's different from thought.
Here goes. And the void that Buddha experienced lasts for four quadrillions of a second, and then it repeats. Anything that hasn't been processed in the previous 1/4 quadrillionth of a second is reiterated into an incarnation.
Right.
That's the next moment.
So that becomes karma or memory that's left over that needs to be cleaned up at some future time.
No, it doesn't mean reincarnation. It means the next moment, the next four quadrillion.
Yeah, but if it hasn't been processed, it gets reincarnated. If it has been processed,
it's finished.
It's done.
That's partly true, but it's also the ongoing of existence. So it has nothing to do with us and our memories and karma. He then says, and then it accelerates up to the speed of light. And when it goes beyond the speed of light, it starts to disappear to us because we can't see it. It's too fast. And you move into consciousness to higher and higher levels, and it just gets brighter and brighter and brighter. But it's invisible to everybody else.
Right.
The point of cosmic awareness was, he says, quote, how can one be aware in that state? And he says, it's simply by being capable of surrendering to an increasing degree past the speed of light and still be able to perceive and to see. We know thinking can't occur, but so thinking can't go beyond one quadrillion. But perception can occur. And then beyond that kind of perception is awareness, which is beyond belief. It's its own stuff in which everything rests. It rests, he's saying, it rests in awareness. In other words, all the galaxies and all the universes and all the time, space, and energy constructs may exist in consciousness, may exist in perception, but when it comes to awareness, they rest in that. The galaxies and energy, time, space, constructs rest in awareness.
Right.
That it is before all of that. Awareness is before all of that.
Right. Yeah, well, that's how I understood what he said.
Yeah, the thing is that the thought is...
thought doesn't occur at the rate of this quadrillionth per second of incarnation of form. Thought occurs at a slower rate, which he iterated earlier as being in the cycles millions per second.
He says a million vias per second. But he talks about, and we get into this, that the Rai created this dimension, and it is essentially thought. So this thought is the boundary of this situation for the human form, and that's four quadrillionths of a second.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we're talking about different levels of thought. There's the level of thought occurring in my brain right now, which is pretty slowed down. Then maybe there's the level of thought occurring in Rai's brain, which is...
We're an extension of Rai. He says that Dave himself says he spends most of his time not in thought.
Yeah.
Most people say, well, just being a couch potato, watching TV. But he claims he's at a higher level. So here's the paragraphs just before that. He says, he talks about, in the beginning, shall we say, there was nothing, what we might call dark energy now. Dark energy, you must remember, is like gravitational waves, maybe something more than that. But I mean, as you go into dark energy, the thing is basically made up of gravitational waves. And as far as my readings and my calibration and the things that I've come across, the gravitational waves that are 16 times the speed of light, or he's saying the gravitational waves, the particular kind that are 16 times the speed of light, that's what they are. So that when something gravitational occurs out there, we don't even know it until it's already hit us, because we can't see that fast, and therefore it's called dark. And of course, the dark energy gives up to a lesser vibes. Now, vibes is not a very scientific term, but anyways. And of course, the dark energy gives up to a lesser vibes, which would be dark matter. And the dark matter occupies a huge amount of the energy of the universe. That the amount of energy that our entire universes and galaxies and worlds, etc., comprise... read that again. That the amount of energy that our entire universes and galaxies and worlds, etc., comprise probably less than 1% of all the energy there is. We think it's incredible, but it's only tiny, meaning our universe. And of course, our science is operated through thought, and we know that thought only operates within about a millionth of the first million vibes. And it has vibe. I put vibes in quotes.
Yeah, that's the part that I was, referring to.
A million vibrations per second. Well, I agree that that's what he said at that point, and that's what I was saying before. But he goes on to define the four quadrillion, and he says that Rai and the form are thought. So it becomes an interplay with the statistics. So I wouldn't stick with million, and I wouldn't stick with four quadrillion. It's either one or both, because he says you get beyond that million vibrations per second, you're beyond thought. And then he says, and the human organism is capable of functioning in form up to about once every four quadrillionths of a second. Now, you could say that the form precedes or is able to live at a higher vibration than thought.
Yeah, that's all I was trying to say.
Right. But I was trying to point out that when you talk later in the interview, we talk about Rai being essentially, he says, thought.
Yeah.
So that means that thought is what form, that our forms are thought.
Right. So that
perspective.
That then augments what was said previously.
Right. Now, to bring it back to McLuhan said that the speed of thought is faster than the speed of light. And he discusses media in terms of the speed of light, doesn't get into thinking other than that his patterns of thought bypass the electric speed up at the speed of light. When I get into what I write, post-McLuhan, I say the Android meme operates not at the speed of light, but at the speed of thought. That's why it becomes Rai on the chart.
Yeah.
It mimes the creation of this dimension.
Yeah, I think McLuhan and Worster may mean slightly different things when they're referring to speed of light, which isn't really defined, and speed of thought and so on.
Any two minds will disagree. That's what you call semantics.
I know E.J. Gold, who's a Gurdjieff Fourth Way Extension teacher, wrote in the Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus that you need to transcend speed of light in order to enter the waking state. That's how he referred to it. The waking state would be transcending the muddled thought world that we generally are accustomed to living inside of, the sleep or the dream state.
See, that's why any two minds that meet will disagree. Because one will establish the boundaries of limitation and say, we need to go past that.
Mm-hmm.
But what one thinks that they are going to go past, another person may find easy from their perspective to go past, and that ain't the challenge.
No.
So, I mean, from that person's perspective, that another semantic, jargonistic concept or thought would be expressed to say, no, this is what we got to do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no way would McLuhan agree with Worster. I read McLuhan. Dave Worster's commentary on McLuhan, in other words, in trance, Cosmic Awareness's commentary on McLuhan. I read it to McLuhan.
Oh.
I got it from a reading, and he said, that sounds like a lot of double talk. Okay? The thing is that LaRouche, from my perspective, LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and Roush, Thompson, Croker, McLuhan are all talking and seeing the same thing. And they have different semantic personality constructs in relating to it. And if you get them in the same room, they wouldn't agree.
They each have a different bias.
Yeah, they each have a different bias, which is natural for human perception.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was just reading an essay by LaRouche, and he's talking about figure and ground. He says, if you want to know what's going on, you got to look at the decisions the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, makes and relate it to MySpace and Facebook events.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to link what we call, you know, high governmental structures to pop culture media masturbation,
right?
The cyberspace. He says there's a common ground to them. Now, that's what McLuhan says. McLuhan would point out Elvis and surfing and JFK and say there's a common ground that they're all resonating with.
Mm-hmm.
The same idea as LaRouche's idea.
Right.
But then LaRouche brings in a technological liberal or humanist situation, and Thompson brings in the Buddhist version of it, or post-Buddhist version. McLuhan brings post-Thomas version, and Croker brings in post-TV body version.
Right. And then I don't have it right in front of me, but in Up the Orphic Ante, you point out that each of these guys has a bias. And what's unique about the Bob Quadrant is that Bob had to transcend all biases as a requirement for survival in your position as a Secret Council of Ten guy.
Yeah, as the Tetrad manager. Now, that's a bias, to operate without a bias.
Oh.
Okay.
I never thought of it in those terms.
Yes, McLuhan once said, now here's an example of McLuhan saying the same thing I'm saying. He said, the bias of our time is to study the bias of other media.
Mm-hmm.
Or to study the bias of media. He says that in Counterblast, came out in 69. The bias of our time is to study the bias of different communications media.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he does.
But see, I take it from your statement in Up the Orphic Ante that your bias can include the biases of all the other guys without taking a bias as to which one's right.
Right, and that's why I say Worster, David Worster, is still alive and talking to me because he is doing what I'm doing. He can talk and be well-versed in the Thompson quadrant, the McLuhan quadrant, the LaRouche quadrant. He can talk conspiracies as well as anybody else. And he can talk Android meme stuff with Croker, and he can talk my stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what's interesting, is to have Worcester on tape now discussing, and we're transcribing it, discussing the situation. We don't have... LaRouche is not available. Well, I've done LaRouche. I've done... Not Thompson, because as part of his strategy is he doesn't go in the media. He will not be interviewed as a matter of principle by anybody, as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then Croker, I've done him. But the thing is, they can't get nutty. They can't get into the world of what Dave's talking about, like Rai in a quadrillionth of a second, which are probably not recognized statistics. I don't know where Dave gets that from. Maybe it's from awareness. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
These mathematical definitions, I don't know. I've never seen anybody else say them.
Right.
You know what I mean? That the form works at one quadrillionth of a second. These are probably coming from awareness.
Yeah.
He uses that. But he's always erasing those terms and saying he's not operating in that level. That's why whatever we're doing here, we're doing thought. And thought is not where Worcester wants to live. He doesn't want to stay within that limitation. So to talk about the Android meme...
No, as a matter of fact, he defines thought as the arena of paranoia.
Right.
Because it's the man that's always assessing a situation and thus projecting what may or may not happen and thus creating paranoia.
That's where he's into the Croker level talking about the post-human. He says now that Rai's returned to essence, we don't know what, in Rai created man, we don't know what is left of man. And I raise in the dialogue, is the cyborg the leftover of man? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's where it gets into the Croker element. But Dave solves the problem by going beyond form.
Yeah.
So that... So the Android.
Well, he said the Buddha did that. I don't know if Dave or anyone else has been able to accomplish that feat of going beyond form.
Right. So the Android meme. A meme is really a thought pattern. Now, when we move at the speed of light, and as I say in my essay on McLuhan, as we get tinier and more holopathic, we're moving at the speed of thought, which is a meme generation. So the Android meme is life at the speed of thought. And it shifts rapidly from one thought to another, from one, you could say, one millionth of a second to the next millionth.
Yeah, which you seem to be able to track the Android meme's thoughts. You're having to explain all this to me because I'm having a hard enough time tracking my own thoughts.
Right. Well, the way I'm trying to give you a way to not get bogged down in trying to track your thoughts.
Yeah.
You have to do it, but you have to be detached from it. So we're giving, we're basically saying the Android meme thinks anything that you would think before you think it.
Yeah.
That should relax you a bit. And you should look at what the Android meme is attempting to think.
Yeah.
And my chart is a picture of that. It attempts to think old human memes. So
right.
Technological liberalism, Catholic Thomism, Buddhism, Marxism and the chip landscape.
Right. Now,
okay, those are memes.
Here's I'm lifting this from Up the Orphic Ante. You're quoting McLuhan, and it seems like a good thing to say right now. First time in history, man now has the means of observing social processes as the process of redemption. He can do this because the social process is the analog of the process of sense perception and interior cognition. Does that relate to what you're saying?
Yeah. Say that again. I thought you were going to go further. So
well... Let me go back.
Read it again.
From where I started or from a little further?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Okay. Okay, actually it spells out into the most practical, political, and social consequences for each one of us. What Joyce is saying is that for the first time in history, man now has the means of observing the social process as the process of redemption. He can do this because the social process is the analog of the process of sense perception and interior cognition, and the process of perception is that of incarnation. How's that?
No, that's good. Is that what you read before?
Oh, yeah, but I read a little more on either side.
Okay. No, that's good. And there's that word incarnation, which Worcester says.
Yeah.
Only he, the person, would say, you have one quadrillionth of a second incarnation, and then it shifts to the next incarnation, mm-hmm. or the next moment. Yeah, that's, it's bulky what I say there, but it's saying that you can see this situation. And if you read the interview with Worcester that we did recently, he is saying the same thing that I'm saying there. You can see the process of the speed of thought created life and see through it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard. He says later that that's why it's hard to ask someone to become aware, because they've got to lose their mind.
Yeah. And awareness transcends Rai.
Right. So the thing is that the android, we live totally in thought now, which is like the last gasp of being a human. It's what makes us human, and it's all we got left. Since the chemical body is
garbage. Oh, I don't know. I still don't want to get hit by a Mack truck when I'm crossing the street not paying attention.
Yeah, but you may not know that of when you wake up assuming you die, you may be happy you're dead.
Yeah, no, I may be, but still, that Mack truck is going to hit me pretty hard whether I'm thinking about it or not.
Yeah, but that's temporary. You then get into the next dimension, we can assume, and you start thinking. What are you going to think about? You got to think about what's happening to here, where life is happening at the speed of thought and canceling out bodies.
Right.
Though the bodies are in some way coming back because the media is shrinking. It's just that it has no framework to talk to someone else about.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no common thought pattern that has any staying power.
Right.
Remember, these quadrants are subatomic, meson, baryon, demon nuclei, etc., showing the speed that they move. It's like each quadrant is a quadrillionth of a second.
And they're all interpenetrating.
And they're spiraling. Remember, they're Orphic Baroque spirals.
Yeah, spiral is an open-ended a spiral gets bigger as it spins.
But LaRouche takes the opposite version. He says the spiral gets tinier.
Right, it spins down into an infinitesimal point.
Yeah, it's
where the energy becomes more compressed.
Right, and it's the image that Worcester presents as what Rai did to create dark matter, because it's a lower vibe than dark energy. So the idea of spiraling down into a denser form, which is where we are now from that perspective, LaRouche advocates that, and that's why we stick LaRouche in the Rai quadrant, because he's actually acting out the spiral dynamics that Worcester says Rai followed.
But according to the laws of media, once that spiral gets down to once it reaches a certain level of intensity and tininess, it has to flip into its opposite and start spiraling back out again, probably.
Yeah.
There was a theory for a while that black holes are the other side of white dwarfs that are, some massive collapse of energy occurring in some other dimension.
I've got them on the chart.
Yeah.
Go. I think it's right at the top there. It says,
in other words, on the other
black
side.
Black hole, red giant, white dwarf, quasar, pulsar.
Right. So on the other side of a black hole where all this matter and energy is being consumed, never to be seen or heard from again, it's spewing out into some other dimension as some kind of a giant, maybe a new Big Bang or some huge solar furnace or something.
Yeah, now McLuhan says he dealt with epicycles. So a spiral, a tetrad could be a spiral. It goes out and then curves. It in the curvature retrieves something and obsolesces something else and then flips into itself. Comes full circle.
Following the form of the Mobius strip.
Yeah. So the so that tetrad does one circle and then it flips into another tetrad. So I'm just it's like you were taking the tetrad as going down and then it flips out and goes back up. But I'm just taking McLuhan saying they were epicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a bunch of circles.
Mm.
So the Android meme as thought, and so that McLuhan says the speed of thought is faster than the speed of light. And so he's saying thought can bypass the situation.
Yeah, you got to
I didn't finish. Worcester comes along and says, no, we're going faster than thought. Now, McLuhan, who knows what he would say to that? You might balk at that, right? Thompson might dig it. Croker would say, well, if you go past the speed of thought, then you've arrived at the android cyborg. Then you're a cyborg. And Dave would probably say yes.
You know, I think thought, at least in terms that generally when we think of thought, we're thinking about, you know, the thoughts that occur inside someone's head. Now, those thoughts occur at a speed lower than the rate of the nervous impulses in the brain, which is slower than the speed of light. So I would say thinking occurs at a rate slower than the speed of light, just based on the fact that it has to occur at a rate slower than the synaptic chemical actions going on inside the 2 pounds of meat you have inside your head.
Right. So if McLuhan was in the room with you, you guys would argue over that.
Yeah.
Because you have your pattern of information based on your sources.
Well,
his pattern.
Yeah, but my pattern is he would have to contend with the fact that the thoughts going on inside your brain are occurring at a rate slower than the speed of light. Now, if he's thinking of thought in terms of maybe the Android meme doesn't have neurochemical processes and that's some kind of faster thought, then we're talking about two different levels of thought.
You're citing biochemical sources for your statement. He might not agree with those. He might not use those. He might not acknowledge them.
Yeah. By the time he can translate anything into language, whether spoken or written or gesture, it has to go through his brain and nervous system to be expressed, and that's occurring at a rate slower than the speed of light.
Yeah, you're assuming he believes that one's limited by biological models of perception, like the brain and nervous system.
Yeah. And he probably, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that he wasn't.
Oh yeah, there's a lot. He didn't agree with any of the scientific models. He just pointed out how the scientific models were conditioned by the media of their day. He said, you people are embedded in a medium, and the medium will make you think certain thoughts, and the thoughts you come up with, you think are the facts. But you don't know they're a product of the medium you're in. That was his point.
I was looking at some esoteric religious slash type thinking the other day in a book, and it was insisting that you must come to the recognition that you are not the body. So maybe on some level that you're not the body. Thought could happen faster than what it occurs in the body.
Right, and McLuhan was accused of being a mediumistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So looking at the chart here, we're looking at the ratios of the causal body to water, to the rhizome, to the solar plexus chakra, to 1965, to the role of the priest, and the meson, and guanine, the DNA constituent. Now, it's 22, right? because it's tactile. It's a metaphoric, interactive process as opposed to seven.
Yeah.
So you see, you then go into the next quadrant where you got
22. The 22 represents a kind of a reflection. Maybe LaRouche is trying to get past that hall of mirrors, or that reflection of perception and thought, and get
that's
in.
True. Let me respond to that. That's what Plato does. He goes beyond the interaction of the sensory mirrors. The Aristotelian, which is more supposedly LaRouche's, McLuhan's angle, is within the mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
He calls them the analogical mirrors. That was one of his first essays.
Right.
So he puts on the Aristotelian. Assuming McLuhan is not an Aristotelian, he puts on the Aristotelian mode because it's more appropriate to an inflated sensory environment.
Yeah.
Where it's very hard to find a means to be a Platonist within it. You're too surrounded.
Yeah, and a detail worth mentioning about the mirror, which I picked up from the Orphic Ante, is to remember that the mirror reverses the image. So there's a reversal going on between two images that are miming each other in the reflection of a mirror.
Yeah, well, you have that in the tetrad. A is to B, C is to D. The enhancement is to the retrieval as the obsolescence is to the reversal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you get the reversal aspect right in the tetrad, which is a four-part structure implied by the 2-2.
Right.
So the now you got do re, it's re in there, and do re mi fa sol la ti do. So the McLuhan quadrant is re.
You could think that resonates with the word ray, R-A-Y, which is radiation, which is good for TV, the TV quadrant.
Well, radiation is more. It could be that, but it's more the radial of the radio environment. He talks about the difference between the radial and the telekinetic.
Uh-huh.
He assigns the radial to radio, not necessarily to the electric.
Oh.
I mean to television.
Hey, I got to interrupt for a second while I'm thinking about it. I meant to find this little clip from this radio I was listening to the night before last to play for you, so I'll just have to remember it because I didn't clip it. But what it was that they you know how they're pushing the limits on the cyber gaming. You know, people get strapped in with their equipment in front of their computer, and they hook up with other people in other parts of the globe, and they get into these intense gaming situations in cyberspace.
Yeah.
Well, this is really happening. Some of these cyber game people are inventing technology that allows you to start manipulating your little avatar mentally.
Right.
And so the next stage of cyber gaming is that you're gonna turn on your computer, I'm going to turn on my computer, and five other people are going to turn. We're going to get into a cyberspace, and we're going to be entering into collective clairvoyance where we're just mentally moving our icons around in a gaming situation and getting rid of the mouse and the manual joystick and all that kind of stuff. These gamers are these guys are actually working on technology to do that. I don't understand it, but talk about voluntary ESP.
Right. And David Cronenberg's movie from 25 or more years ago called Scanners. Did you ever see that?
No.
Yeah, these guys would have ESP battles, and whoever lost had his head blown up. So we have causal body in the McLuhan quadrant because McLuhan claimed to be dealing with the causes. And also the tactile position is not a position, but watching the interplay of other positions. So that is looking at what causes things and maybe being a cause yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the causal body is in McLuhan. It's a pun partly on his emphasis on formal causality.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
And the mental body in the LaRouche quadrant is more Platonic, implying just the word itself.
Right.
So the
And why the analytical positivism?
Because it's a form of detachment and studying things. Analytical positivism says it studies events in their own terms. Doesn't have a judgment. Supposedly doesn't have a value judgment about it. Just
so positivism doesn't have anything to do with positive thinking or something.
No. It's the scientific method. What people say, well, I'm going to be scientific. I'm just going to look at what the situation is and find out what the facts are. That's the positivist ideology in science, which LaRouche is against.
Yeah.
McLuhan said that he studied media in his own terms. He said empirically. Empirically is another word for analytical, or at least the positivist. The analytical positivists were actually a particular school of philosophers.
Right. Which McLuhan doesn't necessarily agree or disagree with. In the LaRouche quadrant, we established that that nominalism is in there, but it creates a polarity because LaRouche doesn't like nominalism.
Right.
In the McLuhan quadrant, the analytical positivism is there, but it doesn't create the same polarity because McLuhan doesn't have a value judgment about it.
Right. So when McLuhan claims he's being a positivist, and then people see that his methods of doing it aren't really technically positivist, they'll say he's schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that he appears schizophrenic because he puts on the positivist method because that's the one that was conditioned to dominate in the last, 19th and 20th centuries, say.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever its period reigned. It's kind of breaking down now, but that's understandable because we've got a new media environment.
Right.
But why is the priest... See, the King Lear is the mature, detached tetrad manager watching the young beings and the new young products of electric media go through their crisis. And King Lear has to figure out which one's going to be capable to take over the reins of tetrad management.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason we put priest in that in the McLuhan quadrant instead of politician is that media icons are the new religion, the secular myth-making machine.
Yeah, it doesn't have religious connotations.
No, it has shamanic, not literate religion. It has ancient religion connotations. McLuhan used to say that rock was shamanic, claiming it has, the bands claimed they had spiritual values to offer.
Yeah.
So the electric media stars become the new form of religion, what Tony Schwartz called the second-hand god. And therefore, McLuhan's critique of that is to be the high priest of media to wake up the secular priests or the stars like Marilyn Monroe to Mick Jagger to Frank Zappa to Alan Watts to Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
He's the high priest chastising them for becoming what they beheld.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have priests in the media quadrant. Electric media quadrant, right?
Right. And why?
The hippies versus straights is obvious. That was a dynamic in that period.
Yeah. New York versus Chinese is not so obvious.
Yeah, I explained that. That the Chinese are what the young kids celebrated because the kids were trying to retrieve tribal communism, the closest social institution that resonated with the software communism of the television era. And New York was the secular media religion.
Right.
The celebrity culture, which heightened up the individual versus the tribal mind melt of software Chinese, in quotes, communism.
Right.
It's another version of East versus West, just like Egyptian versus Paris is East versus West.
Right.
When you get to the next quadrant, Atlantean and Tokyo, that's a different dynamic.
Hmm.
Atlantean isn't even a bona fide, recognized culture. But by that time, you've been so evaporated that even media starts to disappear.
Right.
So you have the model of an evaporated culture.
Right.
Atlantis. And it blew up. Everybody's worrying about nuclear war in that period, 67 to 72.
Oh, right, yeah.
I mean, that's what Worcester his gang creates the Kahuna Ring to counter that.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a number of occult groups out there claiming that they were doing stuff to stave off the inevitable
nuclear war.
Nuclear war.
So the now Bob Dylan fits in there.
Yeah, and that's interesting. How is it that Bob Dylan? Now Bob Dylan we're in the McLuhan quadrant, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that the McLuhan quadrant can give birth to both Bob Dylan and Frank Zappa, because they're not on the same side of the fence.
Well, the Bob Dylan represents the amateur culture, the post-literate culture, the ones that create their own voice. They don't follow any prescribed musical, conservatory, literary definitions of performance.
He carries on the tradition of the Beats.
No, he retrieves black blues musicians, country singers, all kinds of the American folk art of singing.
Yeah.
I remember Mick Jagger's mother once said that he was really concerned whether he was a singer or not. I think she said he was insecure and he needed to find out whether he was a bona fide singer. What he was doing, being a literate, educated British person, he was trying to see if his instinctive ability to sing, molded on rock and roll and blues, would be accepted in relation to the high culture or just the traditional culture of literate music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when he gave that concern up, but once he became successful or sold a lot of records, people thought he was music. So he probably didn't have the issue anymore, and he recognized he was into a new world.
Yeah.
But, you know, growing up, he probably wondered if he was a singer.
Yeah.
If he was going to be professional enough, because he was looking at it through a rearview mirror. So the electric age, the television requires new sound textures.
Yeah.
Any kind of voice is a candidate. Get your 15 minutes.
Seems like Dylan is a kind of an anesthetic. And Zappa just comes in and blows you up.
Right. And Dylan, remember, this is the satellite effect. Dylan's going to free up the program music environment, the program teen market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's on automatic pilot. He comes in and has a different kind of voice, a different kind of attitude, and indifference, and insouciance, a sense of humor, and a sneering quality. Plus, he kind of puts in literate ideas, what's called poetry. He embeds that into the pop tune.
But it seems to me that he's an effect of the McLuhan Quadrant, whereas Zappa is an anti-environment.
Zappa is trying to be an anti-environment. And you can't be an anti-environment as an individual, but he's the most articulate attempt or probe at being an anti-environment. I used to say, Jerry Fialka likes this idea. I said that the ecstasy that black music creates in the 20th century, what is the anti-environment to that? And you know Zappa's thinking that because he writes this article in Life magazine in June 68, where he says, he ends the article, which is sort of a history of rock and roll in the 50s and 60s, and then he says, you're in a nightclub, you're dancing wildly away with, as Lewinham Lewis would call it, a dithyrambic spectator. You're in the throes of electrified utopia, and someone comes up and taps you on the shoulder while you're in this Dionysiac abandon and asks you if a society has, if there is a force of this power that's making you be in this ecstatic state, would you think that a society that needs all the friends it can get would use this? And you don't know, what is the society that needs all the friends it can get? Is it your society? Is it Frank's society? Or is it the Johnson administration? You know what I mean? It's ambiguous what it is, but he's pointing out the hypnotic effect, like a Wyndham Lewis or even a James Joyce, of the electrified music environment, and he's trying to get you to see through it. So with that in mind, that supports my contention that he tried to create a musical landscape that was an anti-environment to the ecstasy and success of black music, or the true American music, from blues, jazz, and on up, right?
Yeah.
or on in.
So rather than going with the flow, he decided to confront the tide.
Exactly, like Wyndham Lewis did. Remember, Lewis had a journal called The Enemy. McClellan said he was the enemy. Definitely Zappa acted like he was the enemy.
Yeah.
So Zappa, McClellan, Lewis resonate.
Yeah. And they're all dealing with chaos in their own way. They're using chaos is the energy that's energizing everyone.
Yeah.
But they're all using it in a different channeling. They're channeling chaos in their own way.
And Dylan does it. He's channeling chaos in the pop culture folklore level. He's doing Zappa on the non-genius trained conservatory tradition that Zappa mastered and then mutated.
Yeah,
you remember? I mean, Dylan was not conducting orchestra.
Dylan's intuitive.
Yeah, it was intuitive. And so that sense, he was a
Zappa's calculated.
Zappa retrieves individualist 19th century Gutenbergian values of the genius composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's able to put on that arena as well as all the other areas he puts on. He's more comprehensive than Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever ask the Evergreens that Zappa was like an incarnation of a Beethoven or something?
I asked Dave Worster that. Cosmic Awareness.
Yeah.
You know, when Dave Worster was channeling Cosmic Awareness, I asked him, and I have it typed up somewheres in, when was this, 1969, early 1970, I was out there, and I said, was Zappa a reincarnation of a musician? And they said, no. They said that one of his lives that resonates with his present Frank Zappa musician world was that he was an African who made glass-shaped ceramic buildings, like the panels, the tilings.
Oh.
You know, that complex art form of decorating, I guess it would be a Muslim architecture.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Somewhere in Africa. In other words, he was a craftsman with fine, detailed, exquisite, decorative agenda.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what he does with his big note project.
Maybe he's got a bit of the Quran in him, and that is also an anti-environment to Western.
Oh, he does. He had Arab and he had Lebanese or Arab and Sicilian and French. He had four or five things in him.
Mm.
But anyways, the basically like working with tiles and ceramics. But so you see that Zappa, McLuhan, and Lewis are too complex, too detached to become icons the way Dylan is becoming an icon for the baby boomers. Because Dylan survived that period about 10 years ago when he almost died, right?
Yeah.
And then he's got these albums, and he's the only guy around with a reasonable, huge irv, and he's getting the status of a gray eminence, and he's produced a lot of great music. He's acceptable.
Right.
You know, he can become the national poet laureate kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not an outsider like Zappa or McLuhan or Lewis. Like McLuhan said, Lewis will never be understood on a big level. You could say Zappa won't be, and neither will McLuhan.
Yeah.
It's not that. Is Dylan the same?
Zappa,
as Zappa?
Celebrated his not becoming an icon by putting all the offensive words in his music, which meant that he couldn't be played on the radio. He almost was doing a Bob. He was like, I want to stay small.
Right. And he said,
small is potent.
That's right. And he said, they asked him, how would he like to be remembered? And he says, I hope I'm not remembered at all. Whereas Dylan will be remembered.
Yeah.
He has created so many different kinds of music for different decades that he's part of the curriculum that teachers will tell students in music schools. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like Bukowski versus Ginsberg. Ginsberg is well-loved, you know?
Yeah.
Bukowski's an outsider. But I was going to add something else. So the thing is, Dylan is in there in the quadrant. It doesn't mean that Dylan's like Lewis, but he's a ratio and attention similar to Zappa, but not exactly. So there's a polarity within there.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So what is it? Is it about an hour?
Yeah. We still have a little more to do. There's cultural sociology and then the first world, the media.
Sociology.
Yeah, I know. I had another question about that, but basically the media state, first world, that whole thing needs to be analyzed.
Oh, well, that refers to the oligarchy, the richest people that came out of Western industrialism.
Yeah,
it didn't come out of the second world, which is Russian bureaucracy. Basically, you could say the Freemasons and the Jesuits,
right,
whatever you want to say, are the Illuminati of the Western world, the ones that have the most advanced, what's considered American technology. Okay, the wealthiest.
Yeah.
You could say Bill Gates is part of the first world. They move forward by creating new second nature environments, like electric media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's since
1900 to 1918 is part of the locking down of one-half world government on the formula chart.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about corporate executives.
Yeah.
And the emperors that create new environments that governments and the Illuminati have to adjust to.
Mm-hmm.
But so these corporate environments that are made, that come out of the most advanced stages of capitalism, that can invest in these new environments, like the Pentagon. The Pentagon is creating these. You know, there's a picture in a LaRouche magazine of one of these military soldiers with a helmet on, being trained to guide his plane or his rockets or whatever cyborg soldier he's going to be. And it's called the Tactile Situation Awareness Lab. They actually use the word tactile.
Hmm.
Tactile, this is created by ARPA, and the sub-project is the AugCog, meaning Augmented Cognition. So the AugCog department is using a tool called the Tactile Situation Awareness Lab. There's the use of tactility as a term in the first world,
mm-hmm,
in the most advanced labs of the Pentagon.
Hmm.
Okay,
which is the ground, shows the ground here, proprioceptive tactile.
Yeah, yeah. So there you have, the ground is called tactile in my chart, and that's actually what the one of the most advanced labs in the Pentagon is called, the tactile lab. Case closed there for the use of the word tactile.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And then, now where it says visual, acoustic, kinetic, and osmic is figure. Visual does not correlate to the visual spaces we defined.
Yeah, no, that's it. Yeah. No, that is. See, it's got what it has. It has most of the senses.
Well, no, yeah, but there's we talked about this last week. There's visual as part of the multisensual experience of your sensory matrix, and then there's visual space, which is literate, the eye fragmented, and I take it to mean what you're saying. Visual here is multisensual visual.
I mean, it's literally the sense, the eye.
Yeah.
We have a new. Once you have literacy, you have a new kind of eye.
Yeah.
So visual includes the extensions of it. But
okay.
This is the area where we put in our basic sensory first nature references.
Mm-hmm.
So the visual sense isn't multisensory. I mean, for pre-literate societies, they don't have a visual sense. They got an interplay of senses. They don't categorize the different parts.
Right.
We, though, literate people, start to categorize it. We end up with five senses.
Five senses, yeah.
And that's a product of extended visual space. So visual here, these categories are Western. Visual, acoustic, kinetic, osmic. Any of these, the fact that these are printed words, they're literate media.
Right. But see, in this phase, TV is already is middle tier. It's not even deep ground anymore. So I'm surprised that proprioceptive tactile are still considered to be ground in this stage.
Because I'm taking the five plus tactile senses, and showing the first nature categories that Western man created, and how they are one of the surface effects within the quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that isn't the whole story, because holeopathic television satellite is the whole sensory matrix that a person has in that period.
Mm-hmm.
But within the known categories of sensory apparatus, there's a ratio, just like King Lear. Television is not King Lear, but it resonates the meanings of it as a category and a meme in relation to other situations, all creating a complex symmetry of tensions here.
Mm-hmm.
So the visual, acoustic, kinetic, osmic, and I've left out the proprioceptive, but I could put the proprioceptive up there like I did in the Croker quadrant.
Right.
I have visual, acoustic, osmic, kinetic, proprioceptive, basically all five senses. And then below it is the virtual replay of them, all five senses plus tactility.
Mm-hmm.
So the tactile is in the ground in the ratio of the McLuhan quadrant, and proprioceptive is there to show that the tactile is hard to know since it's not a sense, so proprioceptive is the closest to the tactile.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the complex reason you have proprioceptive tactile. I want to show that tactile is the ground, but I bring in proprioceptive to give something tangible to illustrate what the tactile approximates,
mm-hmm.
even though you can't describe what it approximates. So it's the only that one and the Croker quadrant you see tactile. You don't see tactile in the Thompson and the LaRouche quadrants.
Oh,
because
okay.
It's not a sense. But the McLuhan television is extending the tactile. So you might have a notion of what the tactile is or how it could be perceived because
mm-hmm.
it's been extended. And then it's squared in the Croker quadrant. You take the five senses and they're squared and you make a cyborg or a Beater's organic robotoid. To do that, you'd have to somehow bring in the tactile function.
Mm-hmm.
Which is artificial intelligence and the discovery that fuzzy logic may be necessary for creating a cyborg,
mm-hmm.
an android, with human qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
all
that's
right.
It.
So just give me a little more on cultural studies. I know we already talked about it, but for some reason I didn't quite get how it fits in here.
Cultural studies is the literate position studying other cultures. Okay?
Oh, okay.
Cultural sociology does not have a literate perspective. It's doing focus groups. It's looking at fads and looking at the Nielsen ratings and trends and determining what McLuhan called a profile of the crowd.
Oh, okay, good.
The discarnate crowd. Whereas cultural studies is maybe studying chemical bodies. Cultural sociology begins to study angelic, discarnate, and later superangelic man and its constituents,
right.
called trends, fads, or ratings.
Right.
Okay?
And then I guess this is too much to go into now, but I'm just going to note for future reference, when I read that McLuhan puts on analytical positivism, cultural sociology, electric media, and water forged in cynical Thomism.
So, yeah, you read that, but remember, television does that. McLuhan is the human version of it. And water is the liquidity of TV.
Right.
Now, remember, as media, as television became a heavy cliche in our societies, capital became liquid.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
And the cynical Thomism, the cynical part, I guess, relates to his being a manipian.
To dance on the toes of.
And it's the way in which he is mutating Thomism to fit in with the with that quadrant. We talked about how each of these holeopathic cliche probes is a mutation of the archetype.
Right, and he also is cynical in the sense of putting on a thought form in a world where thought has no staying power. And in that sense, he's a parallel to Worcester.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So let's end with that.
Very good.
Okay.
Signing off for, what's today's date?
March 23rd.
Yeah, signing off for March 23rd.